This is Barbara Leslie, President of the Oakland Port Commission. Oakland International Airport, OAK, is proud to bring you this podcast of KQED's Forum. When you're choosing your next adventure, the smart and convenient choice is to fly the East Bay Way from OAK to destinations across the USA and Mexico. And when you return home, tune in to KQED, always bringing us remarkable stories about who we are and where we live. Enjoy today's episode of Forum.
Take your Wi-Fi further with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity. With fast speeds and reliable coverage, home just got even sweeter with the Xfinity 10G network. Restrictions apply. Not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.
From KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Alexis Madrigal. Namjoon Paik was a groundbreaking video artist whose explorations of the new medium were marked by a gnomic humor and a focus on the beauty that could be extracted from the machines that made television. At a time when electronics were largely the province of Cold War militaries, Paik said that someday artists will work with capacitors, resistors, and semiconductors as they work today with brushes, violins, and junk. SF MoMA has a new retrospective of his work, and we'll discuss his legacy. And for your weekend planning, we'll be joined by the Chronicle's Soleil Ho to talk about picnic foods and spots. That's all next on Forum, after this news. Welcome to Forum. I'm Alexis Madrigal. In the first retrospective of his work on the West Coast, SF MoMA's current exhibition on electronic art pioneer Namjoon Paik features more than 200 works from the artist whose five-decade career changed the way we look at screens, which is, as far as I can tell, the main activity of humanity now. Perhaps the most acclaimed video artist in the world, Paik's early work changed perceptions of television, video, and the boundary between art and spectator through its integration of camera, video, music, and performance. And we're joined today by two contemporary artists and a scholar of Paik's work to discuss the remarkable moment when video was new and his legacy. First, I'd like to introduce Kota Izawa, an artist living in the Bay Area, associate professor of film at California College of the Arts. Welcome, Kota.
Hi, thanks for having me.
We have Peter Sachs Kolopi, a historian of technology and university archivist at Caltech. Welcome, Peter.
Thanks for having me, Alexis.
And finally, Rhonda Halberton, another artist here in the Bay, as well as assistant professor of digital media art at San Jose State University.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So, it's easy when you're looking at a major artist's retrospective like this to lose sight of the actual fact of a person's life and existence. And so I was hoping we could start with you, Kota, to talk about what Paik was like, because as I understand it, you were a student of his.
I was very lucky in my early studies at the Kunstakademie in Düsseldorf to join his video class. And his video class was a really groundbreaking event, was maybe the first video class offered in art school. Back then, art schools focused more on painting and sculpture, and that video class was quite special. Yeah, I had the luck to brush with his
genius. Yeah. What was it like? What was the class like? I mean, were there just, I imagine there's just television sets all over the place and cables and wire and cameras.
It took place in a video lab that was built at the art school. Back then it was not Apple computers. Maybe there was one Apple computer, but it was mostly these like chunky U-matic tape machines and big chunky cameras. Class also in Düsseldorf is quite different from a class at an art college in the US. It's much less academic. We met, on a whim. We didn't have a class schedule. it was more kind of a loose association of young artists that met with an older artist, Namjoon Paik.
Yeah. And what was Paik's actual presence like? Like, what was he like if he were standing in front of you?
Okay, he was, his outer appearance, and I think people would agree who have met him personally, was very often disheveled. Like, he always looked like he just got off the airplane and didn't have time to shave and just grabbed the first clothes out of his suitcase. But that was his style. He looked the same at an opening of a museum show. And then his spirit was just very generous, very kind, very funny, but also quite radical and, I would say, like punk rock. Huh.
Peter, can you take us back to the sort of moment where Paik really explodes onto the scene in the 1960s, when video making equipment is starting to really become available, at least to a small group of artists and other folks?
Absolutely. Thank you. Yeah. And I'll say, to preface this, one of the things I think the exhibit conveys really well is Paik's earlier career as a composer and as somebody who was sort of expanding music into performance art and into visual performance as well. And so you get the sense that he was adding video to this range of artistic practices that he already had. And he started adding video with manipulations of televisions. So you can see in the exhibit him adding magnets to televisions in 1963, but it's in 1965 that he becomes one of the first artists to buy his own video recorder and to start recording his own video in a way that only people working in the television industry had been able to do before. That's a practice that really spreads from Paik being one of the first over the rest of the 1960s and early 1970s to become an artistic movement of this new medium of video, which can be manipulated electronically so that you can produce images that don't look like anything you would see on broadcast television, which is not inexpensive, but still accessible to far more people than a professional television studio. And a lot of the sort of enthusiasm that Paik and the communities around him have for this technology is about more people making their own television and broadening the participation of this technology.
Yeah. And, you know, in your work, you situate Paik in the history of ideas at kind of the intersection of two great and, might I add, extremely Bay Area movements in sort of how we think about being human, the psychedelic and the cybernetic. And how did his work sort of reflect those sort of currents of thought at that time?
So there's a fascinating piece of writing. Paik wrote a number of sort of poetic manifestos, often quite short. And there's a fascinating one where he specifically writes about psychedelic drugs. And he doesn't seem all that enthusiastic about psychedelic drugs. He writes about them as somewhat dangerous. But he sees them having this sort of radical potential to make the individual a sort of complete experiencer. So he talks about how the art world separates the creator, the audience, and the critic. And there are these distinct roles. And he talks about how somebody engaged in a psychedelic drug experience is in a unified role. They are the creator and the experiencer, and maybe there is no critic. He's interested, and I think this is sort of one of the sides of the Paik. He's interested in art experiences where people are the creator and the experiencer. And one of his motivations for being involved in the development of new kinds of video instruments, the Paik Abe video synthesizer is something that also appears in the exhibit that he built with a Japanese television engineer, Shuya Abe. This is something that someone can take and they can make their own art and experience it themselves rather perhaps than making it for an audience. And that's something he sees as distinctly psychedelic, that unified experience. The cybernetics question is maybe a bit trickier because there is a version of, for Paik and many other video people, a version of cybernetics, which is also about very similar, that feeding back the self, putting oneself on a monitor and then seeing it and creating a loop that way. But there's also a sense of cybernetics for Paik and many other video artists that's about creating a more tightly interconnected society, about everybody seeing everybody else's perspectives on the world. And this also becomes a sort of motivation for trying to turn television from a broadcast medium where there are only a few entities, a few businesses, a few networks that can produce television to a medium that is much more widely participatory and in which there are many more creators.
Yeah. And, you know, cybernetics was once one of the dominant modes of thinking about sort of human consciousness and technology, focused largely on, you know, feedback loops, this idea that, you know, human beings are constantly sort of taking in signals and processing them. And so the idea that you could see yourself was an obvious way of sort of thinking about feedback. And Rhonda, now, of course, we spend so much time looking at ourselves. We spend so much time caught in these cybernetic loops with ourselves. I wonder how your students actually encounter this work when they're so used to some of the components which were at that time very new.
Yeah, thanks. I think that's a really good question. Walking through the exhibition, I was thinking, you know, what would Nam do with TikTok? It just feels like such kind of like an integral medium. And with my students, he's one of the video artists that, you know, they attach to. And I think for a lot of reasons, I think, you know, part of it's like cultural identity, but I think a lot of it is also, while the students are used to the signal, they're not necessarily used to the objects of like screens, right? So seeing a big box TV for them is totally new. They don't know that, you know, they don't understand the electrons kind of are like moving through space and like hitting a screen. So it's really taking what I think they think of as like an impermeable surface, the screen as impermeable surface, and kind of exposing the guts. And that gives them a lot of freedom to start playing around with TikTok, you know, like where are the points of entry? Where can they break into TikTok or other types of social media or screen-based experiences?
You know, I want to know when you first encountered PAIC, like in sort of what era was it and what was the impact that it had on you as an artist?
Yeah, you know, it's funny, your pre-producer kind of was asking me this, and I was like, oh gosh, I remember seeing, it was TV flag. So he made an American flag out of TVs and used a multitude of images to kind of compose the image of the flag, but also kind of was alluding to the fact that the identity of, or American identity, was necessarily kind of wrapped up in the television, but also in the way that we kind of think about ourselves being seen. At the time, I was 15. I was at the Hirshhorn in Washington, D.C. And up until that point, you know, art for me was like Monet or Van Gogh. And to see this wall, this like massive stack of televisions, it was this cognitive dissonance. It was both so thrilling and exciting, but it just broke open what art could be for me. And, you know, I think it was like that moment where I was like, oh, I'd always been praised for, you know, my ability to render, but here's this other thing that kind of spoke about everyday experiences and use the material of the everyday, like using a television. For me at that time, you know, it seemed super novel, although it had been happening obviously for, I think, you know, that piece was from 1996, but I think, you know, his first video pieces in SF MoMA are obviously from the 60s, so like decades before I was even born. But, you know, I think I love that SF MoMA is doing this show, and I love that there's so many people seeing this work, because I think for a lot of people, art seems, as you said, like separate from the audience, that it's this totally separate thing. And while he's using really conceptual ideas and, you know, very much kind of embedded in philosophy, the work is also really funny, really,
yes.
As Coates is saying, like super punk rock and like totally accessible at the same time.
We're talking about Namjoon Paik's legacy and new SF MoMA retrospective with Rhonda Holberton, an artist living in the Bay Area and an assistant professor of digital media art at San Jose State, Peter Saxkolopi, a university archivist, and Kota Izawa, another artist in the Bay and a professor at CCA. Have any of Namjoon Paik's work stayed with you? Do you remember your first encounter with videotape? Give us a call now at 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. You can get in touch on Twitter and Facebook. We're at KQED Forum. I'm Alexis Madrigal. We'll be back with more Forum after the break.
This is Barbara Leslie, president of the Oakland Port Commission. Oakland International Airport, OAK, is proud to bring you this podcast of KQED's Forum. When you're choosing your next adventure, The smart and convenient choice is to fly the East Bay Way from OAK to destinations across the USA and Mexico. And when you return home, tune in to KQED, always bringing us remarkable stories about who we are and where we live. Enjoy today's episode of Forum.
Welcome back to Forum. I'm Alexis Madrigal. We're talking about Nam June Paik's art legacy and a new SF MoMA retrospective with Kota Izawa, an artist living here in the Bay Area and an associate professor of film at CCA, Peter Sachs Kolopi, a university archivist and historian of technology, and Rhonda Holberton, artist here in the Bay and an assistant professor of digital media art at San Jose State University. I want to talk about a couple specific pieces at the SF MoMA retrospective. The first is called Random Access. And in this case, I think this is actually Peter's wording. Paik has has opened up the literal black box of the tape and has sort of tacked it up on the wall. And then a sort of operator, as I understand it, used to be any participant, but now it's like a person at the museum, sort of has like a tape head, and they go around and they put this tape head that sort of plays the tape on the wall. Let's hear just a tiny bit of what this might sound like. So I wanted to first get sort of Peter's reaction to this, and then I'm going to get the artist's sort of take on sort of viewing or seeing or hearing, experiencing this piece of art. Go ahead, Peter.
Thank you. Yeah, so one of the themes in Paik's work, as Rhonda mentioned, is the materiality of the media that he's using. So a lot of his work really calls attention to the specificity of a cathode ray tube television that now seems antique but was exciting at the time. And was current at the time. And this is an early work that does that with audio rather than with video. And so perhaps it's particularly suited for radio. And it does that with audio by taking the tape that would go inside of a cassette or that would be on an open reel tape player earlier. And instead of treating it as something to be sort of spiraled around itself inside of a cassette, it treats it as just a straight line on the wall. And that, of course, isn't as easily playable. And by giving any participant in the original version, as you mentioned, by letting anyone control the playback, you can play it as fast or slow as you want. You can play it forwards or backwards. You can sample bits of several different sounds in sequence. This sort of shows what's really going on when a tape player is working. Mm-hmm. A tape player seems so predictable and consistent and almost like a machine that we can ignore and we can just focus on the sound itself because of its engineering. But if it can be sort of taken apart, we can turn it into something that's a much messier technology. And a lot of Paik's work was about sort of creating messy versions of technologies that are ordinarily quite disciplined to see what else they could do that isn't usually what's intended by their designers.
Yeah. Kota, what was your reaction when you saw this?
It's one of the pieces that there were many known pieces to me in this show, but this one I hadn't encountered before. I didn't see it in action like you just played on the radio, but I was also struck by it as a drawing and mm-hmm. like using electronics to make a drawing. And that's also one of the parts of Paik's oeuvre that I find so key, that he makes a connection between video and drawing and painting and sculpture, that it's not video, closer to this linear form of television and cinema that we're so used to. And so, yeah, I see it as kind of a beautiful electronic wall drawing.
It's true, because it's really, when it's laid out on the wall in the way that it is in the SF MoMA, it is just a drawing. Like, if you didn't know it had any functionality, it has aesthetic appeal just on that level. And I actually found shooting video of it being played, it was also beautiful up close as well. Rhonda, you know, I wanted to talk with you about this particular piece of work too, because there's in your work, there's also this sort of sense of translating energies, translating frequencies. Is this something that you feel like you learned from Paik, or do you think this was had just been sort of in the air during the time when you've come up as an artist?
I mean, I would love to say that, you know, I came up with this concept on my own, but no, I think, yeah, absolutely not. It reminds me of a piece that stands out to me that, you know, many of the works that I most closely identify with, you know, with Nam's work are super ephemeral. And there's a piece that he did called Listening to Music Through the Mouth. And there's one of the great things about the show is that there's a ton of ephemera from these kind of actions and performances and things that don't last very long. But in this piece, he's taken a record player, just opened it up, and then he's constructed some kind of tube, like hollow tube, that he sticks in his mouth. And at the end of it, the tube is a needle that would normally play the record. But instead of like running the signal through an amplifier, which is how you'd normally listen to a record, he's actually biting down on this tube and transferring the signal directly, the vibrations directly from the record into his teeth and then into his eardrum. So this insertion of the body into the machine in a way is very much like that kind of random access where the body becomes the performer, becomes the machine that amplifies or creates, you know, the signal. And that resonates. Yeah, I've done some pieces with like VR and doing VR Reiki and kind of inserting, you know, human energy, which is, yeah, like that kind of like, I think that irreverence too, like on the one hand, there's lots of components of Nam's work that are very spiritual, but also kind of, you know, will quickly turn itself on its head. And then it becomes quickly. And I think that that kind of holding both things at the same time, I definitely learned from looking at Nam's work.
Well, and I think that there's, you know, probably the most famous piece that's in the show and one of Paik's most famous works overall. It's called TV Buddha, in which a sort of closed circuit TV is focused on a Buddha figure, which is then looking at itself in a small screen. And one of the interesting things about it, you know, when you see it in a book, you might just think like, oh, this like calm contemplative work. When you see it in person, what's everyone doing? They're all taking selfies with the Buddha, trying to see themselves in the screen. And I wonder how you see, you know, people when they push themselves into a work like that, whether that changes Paik's work itself, you know, how you feel about that, Rhonda?
I think in the earlier works a little bit, but at the same time, like if you go to the exhibition kind of towards the end, you see these more explicit references to like self and image, like cameras that are pointed at the audience in a very kind of like, when you stand in front of these, you know, a certain piece, I forget the title of it, but it's three cameras looking at you and then you're kind of on a screen and you're projected. It feels very pointed and almost, I don't know, like not threatening, but kind of like this, the cameras become like an instrument of like surveillance. And I think it, you know, that might not have been something that he was intentionally thinking at the time, but I think definitely the later works, he's kind of talking about self-representation and image. And there's a great piece that's a TV chair and the screen is mounted under the chair and kind of looking up through a clear seat. And then a closed, you know, circuit camera mounted above the chair. So like, if you sit in this chair, you're closing a loop so that the top of your head is now being displayed up to your bum. And it's like, you know, it's just like, it's so lovely, but also this kind of like referencing of like this internal process of meditation is necessarily almost kind of like navel gazing, but also kind of expanding out. And so that when I say he's holding both of those things at the same time, it's like, it's kind of pokey and kind of critical, but it's also like fun and funny and, you know, irreverent is the best way to say that.
Let's add in Eric from Oakland into the conversation here. Welcome to the show, Eric.
Hi, I'm really enjoying this discussion because I think it really starts to talk to where art is starting to meld with how society can manipulate this kind of work. I'm in my 50s, and we started out when I was a kid watching television, seeing movies, and having no way to capture them or control them. Today's artists are able to capture and take items that people have made and rearrange them, and then they become the creators themselves, where back then the technology was out of our reach. We weren't sophisticated really enough to understand it. And now I think it's so refreshing to see people using this as an art form where, you know, painting and sketching has long been, you know, things people did in sculpture. Now this is a very young medium, but it's amazing to see how people are using it and then interacting with it as we have a culture that interacts with selfies and taking their own images and kind of moving them around. So I think it's an exciting exhibit to hear about and wanting to see.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, Kota Aizawa, artist here and professor at CCA, your process maybe on the surface might seem less influenced by someone like Pei. Can you talk about how you make your work a little bit and then how you feel like it does or does not show the influence of Pei?
Yeah, I feel Eric, who was just on the air.
Yeah, that was a plant, wasn't it?
Accurate description of what I do. So I grab things from the internet or in earlier days from VHS tapes and manually recreate them and then put them back out as videos that are projected and put on monitors, not unlike Nam June Paik. Yeah.
So you actually, you know, in one of your famous works, you have the protests that NFL players were undergoing, like actually, you know, kneeling, led initially by Colin Kaepernick. So you'll find video of those moments, and then you're redrawing digitally. You're doing it in watercolors, like a little more detail.
Yeah. So yeah, this is a fairly recent piece you're describing, which I did in the years 2018 and 19. Following the protests of NFL players during the national anthem, playing before football games. And I found these snippets of players doing these protests on the internet and then downloaded them and collaged them into a larger piece and then redrew everything in first on the computer and then transferred it to paper and painted it in watercolor. It's a very painstaking and lonely practice that takes months and months and thousands of hours. And in the end, I had like a 2-minute video that has been shown in art museums throughout the country and beyond.
What is that process of translation from sort of an iconic media moment to your art? What do you think it does?
I think it kind of so I feel you should ask people who actually saw the video what it does, because I'm so close to it, I sometimes don't even know what my work does anymore. But in a way, I feel it kind of creates both a distance and a closeness to the image. We're so used to seeing these images many times a day on our devices, and then to see them remade in a kind of manual form, in a watercolor painting, gives you kind of a new look at them or a new experience of them. And I feel it gives you a kind of more personal experience of what's seen than if you encounter it on your daily news stream.
We're talking about Nam June Paik's art legacy and a new SF MoMA retrospective with Kota Aizawa, a local artist and associate professor of film at CCA, Peter Sachs Kolopi, university archivist, head of the archives and special collections at Caltech, and Rhonda Holberton, an artist. Have any of Nam June Paik's work stayed with you? Do you remember your first encounter with videotape or, you know, other sorts of early electronics? Give us a call now at 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. You can also get in touch on Twitter and Facebook. We're at KQED Forum. Peter, I wanted to come back to you for one more bit of historical context, which is a lot of the work is made possible, essentially, by technologies that were developed for the military. And Paik really, you know, I mean, Korean War is this huge spark for the development of electronics right here in the Bay Area and used by the Department of Defense in what was a really brutal war. And yet you don't really see a ton of that in Paik's work, like this sense that this is actually an outgrowth of the military-industrial complex.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that the sort of social impact of technology for Paik is an optimistic interpretation, right? So you you see him thinking about video, thinking about television as a way for everyone to see each other, for everyone to come to a sort of common understanding. He's very enthusiastic about concepts of global community. So the phrase information superhighway is a phrase that Paik uses before anyone else does. The idea of a sort of shared experience of all of humanity is very vivid, particularly in some of his later work where he starts working with satellites and literally trying to get television signals around the planet. And so that sort of possibility of this technology to create new forms of peace seems more imminent in his work than the origins of a lot of this technology in more violent contexts. A lot of the television technology that shows up in his work was developed during World War II for guided bombers and other kinds of aerial military technology. But I don't think that that's a theme that shows up all that much, really, in early video art generally, not just in Paik's own work.
Yeah, I want to talk about this through one of his other works that's in the show. It's called Sistine Chapel, and it's this massive room at SF MoMA in which there are projections going everywhere. I mean, we're talking like little loops and clips of different video from all over Paik's career, all over the world. And it also has a pretty remarkable kind of soundscape to it. And you've got this world that Paik has sort of created that actually kind of feels almost like being on Twitter, being on TikTok, these decontextualized, recontextualized video clips, which of course we know also support these massive business models of the technology industry. And so, Rhonda, I wanted to ask you, when you're using these technologies like VR and other things that you know also support, say, surveillance, you know, in China or surveillance capitalism here in the U.S., how do you think about using those tools?
Yeah, I think it's a really important point. And one of the things that actually surprised me about, well, Sistine Chapel, it's overwhelming, but it also overwhelming in a sense that it isn't just retinal, which is, I think, our normal experience of Twitter or online, but it's like super bodily focused. And I ended up getting a little nauseous and having to like stand up and walk out of it. But I was also surprised there was, you know, it was kind of in one of his other video installations. He's always, you know, kind of like remixing his own work, but also remixing cultural artifacts from other cultures. But there was this little clip that I couldn't find, you know, the source, but he's got the, you know, one of his famous pieces is he works with a cellist, but he has the cello on his back and he's kind of dressed up like a Vietnam, like military. And he's kind of crouched on the beach and he's like, you know, kind of pulling himself along the beach with this cello on his back. And it was the first time I saw anything that looked like an overt reference to the kind of military. But now I think, you know, obviously with most technologies, it would be hard to kind of find a history that didn't involve, you know, DARPA funding in some capacity, right? So I think
Oh, I think we might have to leave it there, Rhonda. Okay. I'm sorry. Okay. We've been talking about Namjoon Paik's art, legacy, and SF MoMA retrospective with artist Kota Izawa and Rhonda Halberton and historian Peter Sachs. Kolopi will be back with more Forum after the break. Yellow submarine.
Support for Forum is sponsored by Stanford's Master of Liberal Arts program. Have you found yourself reflecting on your life and education? Perhaps you think it's too late or you're too busy to earn a master's degree. Stanford's part-time MLA program is designed for anyone, from recent college grads to retirees, who'd like to pursue an interdisciplinary course of study in the liberal arts. MLA students also enjoy access to the world-class facilities on the Stanford campus. Information session held May 16th. Learn more at mla.stanford.edu.
Coming up in our next hour with Mina Kim, why do we sweat? And why do we spend billions annually on products that mask perspiration, yet also relish the sweaty catharsis of gyms and saunas? We'll talk with Sarah Everts, whose new book is The Joy of Sweat. Plus, Yamiche Alcindor reflects on White House politics and her recent move to the host chair of PBS's Washington Week. To listen to past shows and subscribe to our podcast, visit kqed.org/forum. And for the latest updates on our programs and guests, find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. We're at KQED Forum.
This is Barbara Leslie, President of the Oakland Port Commission. Oakland International Airport, OAK, is proud to bring you this podcast of KQED's Forum. When you're choosing your next adventure, the smart and convenient choice is to fly the East Bay Way from OAK to destinations across the USA and Mexico. And when you return home, tune in to KQED, always bringing us remarkable stories about who we are and where we live. Enjoy today's episode of Forum.
Take your Wi-Fi further with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity. With fast speeds and reliable coverage, home just got even sweeter with the Xfinity 10G network. Restrictions apply. Not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.